Ever had one of those days? How do you know it's going to be just one of those days? Could be different for different people. The shower water is cold. You know your dad's just at the valve laughing when... No. Okay, how else? How do you just know it's going to be one of those days?
Nothing goes right.
Nothing goes right.
Leave your wallet, your keys in the house.
Yeah. Get out the door with two out of the three of your kids. The day before everything went too well, so God is humbling us. Absolutely. We all have days like that, and I don't know about anyone else, but it sure seems like everything happens on one day. You know, once it starts, it just goes. There were days when we were especially doing construction on our house that Susie, about halfway through the day, would just walk over and take my tools away and say, "You're done. You're done today." It's one of those days, and maybe it was... I remember one of those days where I stepped on a box of nails and drywalled a bunch of tools into the wall, and just little things like that. And that was one of the days that she said, "You're done. This is just isn't a day." But we have days like that. You know, we have sayings for it. Have you heard of Murphy's Law? Sort of rises that if something could go wrong, it will go wrong. Or if something's already going wrong, more will go wrong. And I wrote down some of the ones that I thought were rather hilarious or funny. Traffic is only bad on the days you're in a hurry or you're running late. The spouse who snores the loudest always falls asleep first. The heavier the load, the farther you have to carry it, and the more your nose itches. I don't know why this is true, but it always is. The original is found right after a replacement is bought. I don't know if that's true for anyone else, yeah. So, you know, right after we replace them or take care of it, we find the originals. When you have a deadline, some of our students will understand this, the printer always runs out of toner or paper. For some of you that were here trying to make copies last week. Yeah. All these things happen, and those things we could say, well, those aren't really our fault. It's just having a bad day, and it seems like bad days breed bad days, and things that go wrong, whenever we say what else could go wrong, we know that more can go wrong. But sometimes we cause these things, don't we? Sometimes they're of our own volition. This morning on my way to church, just a strange occurrence. I'm driving down the road, and to the right, I pass this car that's facing me. And I slowed down because that's not something you... And it wasn't like it was parked. There were people in it, and their flashers were on, and their headlights are on just facing me. And they waved me around, and so I go around up to Catella, and they pull in behind me, backwards. Who does that? And I'm thinking, well, okay, something's wrong. So I go through, the signal turns green, I wait till that, and then go through. And I look behind me, and they're just driving behind me, backwards. And they're going a pretty good speed, which I don't know if you've tried driving backwards at a higher speed. And all of a sudden their car starts to sway a little bit back and forth because you start overcorrecting and all of a sudden they just shoot to the left. And fortunately there was a street there, so I think they intended to, but it was this weird thing, and I'm thinking behind me, the guy's nuts. I don't know because I'm looking at his taillights, but the guy's nuts, and he is going to get into an accident, and probably did as he made that turn. And that's something that I don't know that he could go home and say, "Man, I'm just having a bad day today." Because he was just being stupid. I don't know how else to word that. He was just doing something that would breed a bad day. That's sort of where we find Jonah this morning. As we looked at chapter 1 last week, and we come to chapter 2 this week, And if you remember chapter 1, Jonah is taking his objections to the people of Nineveh, his hatred for the people of Nineveh, and putting that above God's will. Putting that above what God has asked him to do, and he said no to God. I will not do that. And in fact, okay, fine, I'll rise up, but I'll go the opposite direction. And then throughout the familiar story, we saw the sea coming up and the sea obeying God. And where's Jonah? Down, because we saw the poetic sequence of down, 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 and we're going to see that again today even. He's down in the bottom of the ship sleeping. And the captain asks him to pray, and he doesn't. Because he can't. He has run from God. And so at the end, he says, here's the solution. Throw me into the sea. I would rather die than obey God. Remember that? And that's where Jonah's at. And I would dare say we could probably call that attitude a little bit stupid. I would rather die than obey God. And so the soldiers finally, after trying to row to shore and trying to save his life and not have his blood on their hands, they finally say, we're all going to die anyway, and they toss him over, and the sea's calm. And the sailors are in awe. And they worship and make vows to Yahweh. And we think that's the end. And that's where we left last week, and we read that last verse of chapter 1, because it started with, but God, but Yahweh. That in the middle of all these events, God said, no, that's not how it's going to turn out. My hand is here. I am doing something different. Wake up. And we see the giant fish come and swallow Jonah. And today in chapter 2, we pick up the scene right after that with Jonah in the belly of a big fish. And I find myself thinking, what goes through your mind? It hasn't happened to many of us. What goes through your mind when you're swallowed and curled up in the belly of a big fish? And I think maybe he was wondering, can it get any worse? Can it get any worse? Can anything else happen? And at that moment, we see God intervening and saying, it's not about getting worse. It's about me transforming your will. And this morning, as we look at chapter 2, it's about God's pursuing grace, transforming Jonah's will, disciplining his will, bringing it into subjection to the Maker of the universe. Turn with me to Jonah chapter 2. Jonah chapter 2. I'd like to start just by reading the whole chapter together. Then we'll look at five principles of God's pursuing grace and how it changes our will. But Jonah chapter 2, and I'm actually going to start with verse 17 of chapter 1. But the Lord provided a great fish to swallow Jonah. And Jonah was inside the fish 3 days and three nights. Then chapter 2, verse 1. From inside the fish, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God. He said, in my distress, I called to the Lord, and he answered me. From the depths of the grave, I called for help, and you listened to my cry. You hurled me into the deep, into the very heart of the seas, and the current swirled about me. All your waves and breakers swept over me. I said, I have been banished from your sight, yet I will look again toward your holy temple. The engulfing waters threatened me. The deep surrounded me. Seaweed was wrapped around my head. To the roots of the mountains, I sank down. The earth beneath barred me in forever. But you brought my life up from the pit, O Lord my God. When my life was ebbing away, I remembered you, Lord, and my prayer rose to you, to your holy temple. Those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. But I, with a song of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you. What I have vowed, I will make good. Salvation comes from the Lord. And the Lord commanded the fish, and it vomited Jonah onto dry land. As you hear that that chapter, as you hear Jonah's prayer, and really we get a window into his prayer to God while he's inside the fish. What words come to mind? What strikes you? He's what?
Thankful.
Thankful. Jonah's thankful to God. Why? He's delivered from death. Okay, good. What else caught your attention? Hope. Absolutely. He has hope. And where is he still?
Inside a fish.
Not the most hopeful place, but he has hope because he sees a bigger picture of what's happening. We have all of these elements tied up in this prayer. And I think a background to understanding the prayer is understanding that Jonah had defied God. And the penalty for defying God is death. This man deserved to die. And to understand where the book of Jonah is going at this point, where Jonah himself, as he prays this, is going, we have to understand the expectation was that he should die. Justice said he should die. He said no to God. But we see a different side. We see God's pursuing grace, transforming his will, rather than just killing him outright. A couple of things as we read through this. This is, as we look at this prayer, it's a pretty typical prayer of thanksgiving. So whoever said thanksgiving, that was right on target. It's a typical prayer of thanksgiving for deliverance. And we see this throughout the psalm. Psalm 18 has a lot of elements that look a lot like this prayer. And so it was a structure that was pretty normal, a praise and worship structure, thanking God for what he did. And if you look through the prayer, just as far as the literature goes, we see in verse 2 this verse that summarizes the rest of the prayer. He said, "In my distress I called to the Lord, and he answered me. From the depths of the grave I called for help, and you listened to my cry." And so we see an introduction, and then the next four verses, 3 through about the middle of 6, we see a description of the distress or a description of the trouble. And we see Jonah going down, and we'll get to that as we look through those verses. And then in 6 and 7, we see a report of God's deliverance. A report of God's deliverance. And then in 8 and 9, we see a response, a vow to God. And that's a typical format of a prayer of thanksgiving for deliverance. And we could learn a lot from that format. Just right there of rehearsing to God what he's done and recognizing the depths to which we sink, but then recognizing his deliverance and responding to that. And as we look through this chapter, we want to look at some specific ways that God shows Jonah grace. And he shows him grace not in the absence of discipline, not getting him off the hook for saying no to God, but he shows him grace by conforming his will, by transforming his will. I think of parenting. And parenting is all about molding a will, isn't it? It's molding these young lives and their will. And sometimes those wills are so opposed to what is right and so self-centered. And as parents, we show grace by not killing them. But then we show grace by molding that will, by conforming it to what is right, to what is true before God. And in so doing, helping them their entire lives. And that's what God is doing with Jonah here. He has his child. And his child defies God. And God puts Jonah in time out. In his own little special timeout place. And Jonah's left with nothing else to do. What else do you do in a belly of a fish? You're left with one thing, prayer. Prayer. And I guess he had a choice between prayer and coming to God and bitterness and anger. Look what God has done to me. But he comes to God in prayer. And we see that prayer in these verses. If we're to allow God's pursuing grace to transform our will, there's several things we can glean from Jonah's prayer, which is his experience of God's grace transforming his will. And just for fun, if you look through the five words, we made them spell something today. And it spells grace. So maybe the wording won't be as natural at times, but it spells grace. So we can remember that. But the first point, as we look at the first couple of verses, is if we're to allow God's pursuing grace to transform our will, we need to give in to God's persistence. We need to give in and give up that God is more persistent than we are. We will never outlast God. If you look at verses 1 and 2, from inside the fish, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God. Just take that verse right there. From inside the fish, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God. That verse is loaded with significance. That wasn't just the author saying, and this happened. Do you remember in chapter 1? Turn back to verse 6 of chapter 1. The captain went to him and said, "How can you sleep? Get up and call on your God. Maybe he will take notice of us and we will not perish." And so we see the author bringing back to the first story, and throughout chapter 2 we see comparisons to chapter 1 all through it. And in chapter 1, the captain comes, "Pray to your God." And Jonah doesn't. And he won't. And he chooses death over obedience, death over submission. And we see all of this happens, and then we see but Yahweh as he prepares this big fish. And at the start of chapter 2, we see a reference back to that very attitude. From inside the fish, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God. And we see a picture of God's persistence. And he will pursue, and he will pursue, and he will discipline until we finally turn to him and say, "Okay. Okay. I've had enough. I'll give in." And so verse 1 of chapter 2 represents a huge thing. It represents Jonah giving in to God. And there's all kinds of talk of, well, is chapter 2 really Jonah repenting and coming to God? Or is he just saying what he needs to say to get out of the belly of a fish? He was repenting as much as he could at that point in time. No, it wasn't complete. He didn't come to complete maturity in the belly of the fish. But he took steps. He took steps towards Christ-likeness. And God was molding his heart. And really, how many of our hearts are completely molded into submission to God the first try? None of us. It takes something happening, and then another event happens, and it reveals how self-centered we still are, and God has to hammer us in another area, and his persistence keeps chasing us. But it's profound to me that God gave Jonah a second chance. Okay, the first time you're down in the boat, you don't pray to me with a certain set of trials. So let's make it a lot worse. And let's try again. Imagine if Jonah said no this time. I'm not sure what more could have happened, but God could have had some fun. He was disciplining. He was molding a will. From inside the fish, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God. Just a couple things about that. Prayed to Yahweh his God. There's an element of personal identification here that it didn't exist in chapter 1. So his heart is changing. His heart is changing. So he's finally able to utter the prayer that he was unable to on the ship. And his will is starting to be molded. You know, sometimes God has to take us into circumstances where there's nothing we can do but give up and pray. And I don't know what that is for you. I don't know what it is for me sometimes. But what keeps us from being able to pray? What keeps us from going to God in every situation and going to God and obeying Him in every difficulty? And it comes back to our will. It comes back to, I don't want to sometimes. comes back to the whole direction thing we talked about last week, that I want to be the one that solves this. And if I pray, I'm asking God to solve it, and somehow I'm weaker. But God had to get Jonah to give up. To give up his will. To be willing to ask for help. Be willing to pray. In verse 2, he said, "In my distress I called to the Lord, and he answered me. From the depths of the grave I called for help, and you listened to my cry." And you see a parallelism throughout. You see parallelism or contrast throughout almost every verse in this prayer. But you see him repeating the same concept twice, but with different words. "In my distress I called to the Lord." In the second half, "From the depths of the grave I called for help." And then the second half of both of those, "And he answered me, and he listened to my cry." And I'm comforted by that. Because that tells me that no matter what situation I'm in, no matter how dark things look, no matter how angry I am, or how bitter, or how frustrated, or depressed, that I can call to God, and he will listen. And in that moment, things begin to change. The situation doesn't get immediately better. Everything doesn't immediately fix itself. But in that moment of giving up and giving in to him, things begin to change. I remember leading a Yugo trip in college. And we had an interpreter that was coming with us, and he was our only interpreter. And a day before the trip, he wrote me a letter and said, "Ron, I don't think I'm coming." And in this letter, he outlined, I just don't think I'm right with God right now. And so with me not being right with God, I don't think I should come and be on a missions trip. And I remember reading that letter and thinking, why doesn't he get right with God right now? How long does it take to bring our hearts into submission to Christ? A moment. A moment. And for him to write that, what he was really writing was, I am not right with God, and I don't want to be yet. My heart broke. Because he hadn't gotten to the point that Jonah got to of giving up. Of giving in to the will of God, to the persistence of God. And when we are going through dark times, and when we are going through dry times, it takes a moment to cry for help. It starts a process, but it takes a moment to start that process. And that's what God was getting Jonah to the point of being able to do. "In my distress, I called to the Lord, and he answered me. From the depths of the grave, I called for help, and you listened to my cry." Just as an aside, there's a lot of talk about what it means from the depths of the grave. And the word there, some of your translations may use Sheol. And it was an Old Testament concept of where the dead went, and where all the dead went, actually, the righteous and the unrighteous. And the discussion in Jonah is, well, does that mean Jonah was dead at this point? Is he alive? There's a lot of debate. Did he die for those 3 days in the belly of the well? Or the big fish, sorry. And then God raise him from the dead? Or did God keep him alive that whole time? Either way, it's an incredible miracle. Either way. But as we look through the text today, Jonah is using poetry to talk about descending toward death. And so when he says this, he's talking about, I am at death's door. I am almost dead. And so this in no way says that he was already dead, because then there's the problem of how are you praying? How are you coming to God? But we don't know, is sort of the upshot of that. He could have died at some point and God raised him from the dead. But my point this morning is this text itself does not say that. That's a lot of conjecture one way or another. And it could be that would be a beautiful symbol of Christ's death and resurrection. But I tend to lean more on the side of he was alive in there and God was breaking his will. And God was doing something and preparing him for what he needed to be doing. One other commentator thought that, well, maybe the fish referenced an inn. And when it said that he was 3 days and three nights in the fish, that he was just staying at an inn called the Fish somewhere. They're just trying to get around that God does miracles. God did a miracle here. And Jonah is descending into the depths of the grave because as he's sinking into the water, he is realizing, I am dying. I am dying. So the first thing we need to do to see God's persistent grace wash over us is to give up to him. Give up to his persistence. The second thing is we need to reorient our mindset to see God's hand in our difficulties. Reorient our mindset, our thoughts, how we view things to see God's hand in those things that are so troubling us. The trials we're going through, the difficulties, the things that we might be angry about. Let's read verses 3 and 4. You hurled me into the deep, into the very heart of the seas, and the current swirled around me. All your waves and breakers swept over me. I said, I have been banished from your sight, yet I will look again toward your holy temple. And do you see a difference in how this is described? Who threw him into the sea? The sailors. And so it would be very easy for Jonah to say, I can't believe they did that. Yeah, I said to do that, but I didn't mean it, and they threw me into the sea. And here, as I'm going down, and as I'm drowning, and as water is filling my lungs, it would be so easy to be angry at the sailors. But his wording is significant here. You hurled me into the deep, into the very heart of the seas, and the current swirled around me. All your waves and breakers swept over me. And in Jonah's change of heart, one of the changes was he began to see God's sovereign hand in events and God's finger on what was happening. And so instead of, oh, these random events happened to me, his mindset now has been reoriented to, what is God doing through this? Complete change. Complete change of idea. And when we get blindsided by life, and all of us have, and all of us will, and our temptation is to get bitter and angry and frustrated, we need to reorient our minds and say, what is God doing? Even in a sinful, fallen world, what is God trying to accomplish? Because none of this has surprised him. None of this catches him off guard. And when we begin to see circumstances in our lives as God's hand disciplining, teaching, correcting, we begin to be open to his grace changing our will. And that's the change we see in Jonah. You hurled me into the deep. You still see the metaphor of going down, down, down. He went down to Joppa. He went down to the ship, down into the hold of the ship. And we thought that's as far as he could go. And now we see him thrown over, and he goes down into the waves, and then, as we'll see in the next few verses, down to the bottom of the sea, down towards the grave. His life is getting worse and worse. But as he recalls it, you did this. Not in an angry way, but in a way that starts to see what God is trying to do. In verse 4, I said, I have been banished from your sight. This reflects again, the poetry of Jonah as he's dying, realizing if I die, my decision to follow Christ and worship him is done on this life. And he's realizing that this is the end. As he's sinking into the water, this is it. But yet, as Jim said, there's the hope at the end. Yet I will look again toward your holy temple. Because as he's writing this, this is Thanksgiving. He already recognizes God's deliverance. I will worship again. As we reorient our mind to see God's hands in the events of our lives, it means taking a different mindset even towards discipline. We don't like to be disciplined. Again, as I read through this whole chapter, it just feels like a parent disciplining a child, except this time we're the child instead of the parent. And Jonah had to come to a point of accepting that discipline. Just like children, how we respond to discipline determines whether or not we benefit from it. And with God's persistence, whether or not we get it again. Hebrews 12, verses 5 and 6, as the author is talking about God's discipline. And you have forgotten that word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. Don't just brush it off. Understand it for what it is. It's his discipline. And in the second half of verse 5, and do not lose heart when he rebukes you. Don't run from it. Don't faint from it. But see it as a learning process. Because the Lord disciplines those he loves. And he punishes everyone he accepts as a son. We must learn to see God's hand. But as we see God's hand, and even if it's a hand of discipline and a hand of instruction, the fact that his hand is there means he loves us. And he's part of the process. And that's huge. Because when we get in circumstances that we don't understand and that hurt so much, his hand is still there. And the fact that it's there means he still loves us. And he still is molding our will as only he knows how to do. Johnny Erickson Tada writes this from her wheelchair. I really don't mind the inconvenience of being paralyzed if my faithfulness to God while in this wheelchair will bring glory to him. When God brings suffering into your life as a Christian, be it mild or drastic, he is forcing you to decide on issues you have been avoiding. He is pressing you to ask yourself some questions. Am I going to continue to trying to live in two worlds, obeying Christ in my own sinful desires? Or am I going to refuse to worry? Am I going to be grateful in trials? Am I going to abandon my sins? In short, am I going to be like Christ? He provides the suffering, but the choice is yours, she writes. And what a perspective that she sees God's hand in these trials and in these sufferings, and she sees it as a hand of correction and discipline that is helping her choose the right way in life, a way that follows God and brings glory to him. We need to reorient our mindset to see God's hands in our difficulties. Third, and this is very similar to point number one, except rather than giving up, this is understanding the role of circumstances and difficulties. We need to accept that difficult circumstances might be required to prune our will and drive us to our knees. Accept that difficult circumstances might be required to prune our will and drive us to our knees. Not just one of the ways, but we are so stubborn sometimes. And if you don't admit it, you're just being stubborn. We are so stubborn sometimes that we hold on to our own ways, and God has to take the deepest, darkest circumstances to break through the wall of stubbornness that we have put up. And for the A of grace, we need to accept that those difficult circumstances might be required because of our stubbornness. God takes no joy in them. But he's willing to do whatever it takes because his grace is persistent. Let's read verses 5 through 7. And we see this. We see Jonah as he's recounting how deep he had to fall until at the end of 7, we see the change. Starting at verse 5, the engulfing waters threatened me. The deep surrounded me. seaweed was wrapped around my head. And so he's describing drowning in poetic form, but he's describing drowning. The waters came to my neck as sort of the engulfing, and you see him at that level, and you can picture him fighting the waves. And then the deep surrounded me as he goes under the water. And then you see this picture of seaweed wrapped around him. And can you picture the struggle? Can you picture the fight? And you're trying to stay alive. You're in the storm and you're drowning. And then all of a sudden the seaweed's pulling you down. And he has his clothes that are pulling him down. To the roots of the mountains I sank down. The earth beneath barred me in forever. Probably referring to as he falls and as he drops to death, that's it. There's a finality to it. But then you see the hope again. Because he's writing this after the fact, seeing God's deliverance. But you brought my life up from the pit, O Lord my God. So you see the description down, down, down. But Yahweh again, brought my life up. When my life was ebbing away, literally when I was at death's door, when I thought I was breathing my last breath, I remembered you, Lord. And my prayer rose to you, to your holy temple. And we see in a moment of vulnerability, Jonah say what it took for him to remember God. He didn't say as soon as he hit the water. He didn't say as he was fighting for breath. It took him to be falling down, not breathing anymore, his oxygen depleting out of his body. At the very last moment, it translates as my soul faints. As the very breath of life is fading away, then I remembered God. And it took every one of those difficult circumstances to break his stubbornness. Because you know that is at any point, and we talked about this last week, at any point he could have submitted his will and he could have come broken before God. Because that's all God was trying to accomplish here, was a transformation of the will. And I've got to say, as I read that, not only does my heart break for what he was going through, but as I read that, it rings true. It rings true to the things that I have held the most dearly to the things I have been the most stubborn about. And God had to bring the most painful experiences to shatter that stubbornness. And does that mean he's unloving? No, it means he is loving. And that's why we see the hope. But his persistent grace doggedly pursues us until we finally transform our will, or let him transform our will. What does it take for you? What does it take for God to get your attention? Just as another way of application, just something to think about. We are a loving people, and we love each other, and we care for each other. And it's so hard to see people going through trials and difficulties. And we should be there to help, and we should be there to love. But in the case of Jonah, where he has brought it on himself, and where it is clearly the discipline of God, I think so many times we bail people out way too soon. And I'm not advocating that we should go around trying to, well, that's the discipline of God. I'm not helping you. But I'm going to sit back and watch. That's not what I'm saying. And I hesitate to even bring this up, but I know the rescuer in me sometimes and the rescuer in others, and it's so easy to come and make things all better when God is trying to break a will. And we keep God from breaking wills in our families and in our kids. And moms and dads, that's probably where we see it most. where I'm tempted most is when my kids do something and they're young and the consequences aren't very big. A toy may be broken. But what about when they're teens and they're walking away from God and rebelling against God? And we remove all the consequences from their actions. We are removing the pursuing grace of God. And I know there's all kinds of details of that that we could talk about. But I ask you this morning, do we sometimes bail our kids out too quickly and keep them from learning what God so desires to learn as He transforms their will? Verses 8 and 9, we see now Jonah transferring from, he's talked about the depths, he's talked about God's deliverance, and now he talks about his heart, his response. Those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. But I, with a song of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you what I have vowed I will make good. Salvation comes from the Lord. And the fourth point, the sea of grace, cling to the grace you are missing. Cling to the grace you are missing. In verse 8, those who cling to worthless idols, who cling to things other than God, to distractions, to snares is what it literally means, miss out on God's grace. They miss out on His loving kindness. They miss out on what God was trying to do. And as I look back through difficult times of my life, as painful as they were, and as frustrating and as angry as I was sometimes, I wouldn't change them. Because those are the times that I experienced God's grace and His love deeper than I have ever felt in any other time of my life. And we need to cling to that grace, to that love. Those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. They forfeit that experience of seeing God work in His hand and His chesed, His loving kindness. But then we see a change of heart in Jonah in verse 9. As he clings to that grace, but I, with a song of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you. I will worship you. I will praise you, is what he's saying. And then finally, I will obey you. What I have vowed, I will make good. And his response to God's incredible grace is worship and obedience. He's not even out of the fish yet, but his heart has changed to trust God, to believe that God is doing something. Again, this is a parallel to verse 16 in chapter 1. At this, the men greatly feared the Lord, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows to Him. Sound familiar? Except the sailors got there a lot sooner. It just took a storm for them. It took a little more for Jonah. But God got him to the same place. Worship and obedience. That's where God wants us today, worship and obedience. Because in worship, we acknowledge our will is less than God's. In obedience, we actively take His will and act on it. The E of grace, point number 5, engage your purpose in the kingdom. Engage your purpose in the kingdom. In verse 10, we come back to narrative. We come out of the prayer and out of the psalm of thanksgiving for deliverance. And in verse 10, and the Lord commanded the fish, and it vomited Jonah onto dry land. Again, just a word, fish obeys. Doesn't have to go through any of this. Jonah's on dry land. But what does that represent? It represents God saying, let's get back on track. I asked you to do something. You went the other way. I provided a taxi and we got you partway back. Now let's do what needs to be done. Engage your purpose in the kingdom. Jonah's change of heart, his transformation of the will, even if it was partial, as we'll see in chapter 4, his transformation of the will needed to result in getting back on track with what God purposed for him. And so Jonah finds himself deposited on dry land with a fish that probably had some indigestion from him. Took care of it, and Jonah gets a do-over. It's one of our phrases in our home. Part of our discipline is, okay, let's try it again. Now that you've been disciplined, and let's see what you should have done. That's sort of what Jonah gets. A Sunday school teacher read her class a passage from the Old Testament out of Jonah. And the Lord appointed a great fish to swallow up Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. Then Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the belly of the fish, saying, I called to the Lord out of my distress, and he answered me. And the Lord spoke to the fish, and it vomited out Jonah upon dry land. When she was finished reading, the teacher said, Now children, you've heard the story of Jonah and the fish, and what does this story teach us? 10-year-old boy shouted out, You can't keep a good man down. Think about it. And we laugh about that, but that's really illustrates the point that God still had a plan for Jonah. And death was not part of that plan because Jonah was his prophet and he was going to do the work of God, which was good. And it's not that we can't keep a good man down, but when God's pursuing grace is attached to someone, it can't be stopped, even by a storm and an ocean and certain death. Grace. A lot of different ways to look at chapter 2. We can look at it as discipline. We can look at it as just simply deliverance. Or we could look at it as God's grace changing a will. Not just killing Jonah outright, but working with him and loving him and changing him. And we see a beautiful picture in chapter 2 of God's forgiveness to Jonah. And so now in chapters 3 and 4, God is going to say, that forgiveness I have for you should now be transferred to other people. To the people of Nineveh. And that's going to be a problem for Jonah. We'll just say that right up front. We're going to get there. It's going to be a problem. But it's the sequence of forgiveness that we talked about, that God saves Jonah from certain death and he experiences his grace. But now his next step is, can I see how that grace should extend to others? I love in verse 9 how Jonah ends the prayer. Salvation comes from God. Salvation comes from God. Not from our own will, not from anything we wish or think we can do, but from God alone. Lord God, may praise and glory and honor be to you forever. Because salvation belongs to you, and you reached out your hand and intervened and saved Jonah because you had a plan for him. And Lord, you have reached down and intervened in our sinfulness and our wayward ways, and you have saved us that have come to you because you have a plan for us. May we be touched by your pursuing grace. May we let it do a work on our wills and acknowledge that salvation belongs to you. It is completely nothing that I have done. Thank you, God, for that salvation. We praise you and worship you and obey you. In your name, amen.